I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964. Hello, music nerds and everybody else out there. Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 138 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers, and we are coming to the end of season 6. That's right. There's 3 more episodes. This one, 2 more after this. So it's going to be another 4 weeks, I guess, and those will come to an end. That'll be the end of season 6. Then there's going to be a little break, and season 7 will start after a short break. It's already kind of underway. It's already in production. So that's happening, and I will keep you posted. Meanwhile, thanks for tuning in and listening. I really appreciate you being here. My guest today is the amazing guitar player and producer and songwriter, Mr. John Leventhal. I'm very excited to have John here. I've been trying to get him on the show for a while, and he's a tricky guy to connect to. But a big shout out to my pal Craig Northey. Craig was on the show last season. He is a wonderful musician from Vancouver, and he made the intro to John for this episode to me, because Craig and John are buddies and they've done some work together before, and Craig set me up with John. So thanks, Craig. I'm much grateful for that. So here in Nashville, what's going on? We're deep into the winter here, and I hope it's not screwing up too many travel and touring plans for those of you out there that are on the road. I'm not really touring myself until April, thankfully, but I do have quite a bit of studio work coming up, and that relies on a bunch of people getting here to work. So hopefully things will sort of settle. I know this week is going to get nasty out there again. So be careful out there if you're traveling or if you're a touring musician. Take her easy. Don't do anything too nutty. You know what I'm talking about. Especially you Canadian people touring around out there in the snow. What else is going on? I'm putting out some new music and some live performance videos. Quite a few of those these days. We shot a whole ton of video footage a couple months back live in a studio called Hipposonic up in Vancouver. And those songs are all trickling out now, mostly on YouTube. And I also have a brand new album out, or coming out, called Eyes Closed Dreaming. That's coming out in March. And, you know, you can look that up and have a listen. It's all easy to find. You know how to do that, people, on the Spotify and the Apple Music and whatever you do your music listening on these days. It's all there. And links to that are over at my website as well at stevedawson.ca. So a couple reminders. One is for the Hen House Hang, which is happening here at the Hen House, my studio, September 25th through 28th this year. It's going to be a really fun four-day seminar on recording based around roots music, Americana, whatever you call it. All kinds of cool stuff is going to be happening over those 4 days while we record some songs and learn the process of recording and mixing. There's only 8 spots available. There's a couple spots left, so hit me up if you're interested in finding out more. And you can get info on that whole thing at stevedawson.ca as well. And there's a link to the Hen House Hang right on the front page. And then anyone interested in helping out the show, if you sign up now to the Patreon page, which can be as low as just a few bucks a month, you will be entered to win this cool Union Tube and Transistor C-Verb reverb pedal. It's really cool. It's super trippy. I've been using it quite a bit and it's really fun. I am going to be giving one of these away at the end of the season, which is, you know, just a few weeks from now. So you can support the show in other ways too, but Patreon's a great way to do that. And you can get info on that over at makersandshakerspodcast.com, the home of the podcast. And of course, many thanks once again to all the Patreon supporters and donators to the show. It all really helps. And a big thank you to everyone who has left a review for us over at Apple Podcasts. There's a couple one-time donators this week as well. So thank you to Jim Franklin and Suzanne Watkins. I really appreciate you guys, and it's very helpful to keeping the show going. All right. So John Leventhal, he's a bit of a man of mystery. And I love having these folks, these kind of people on the show that don't have websites. They don't really have a presence out there beyond just making great, cool music. And John has done tons of amazing work over the years, but there isn't a lot of info out there, or at least easily accessible info. So John first came on most people's radar as a producer and co-writer and guitarist for Sean Colvin. That was in the late 80s. And he comes out of that New York studio scene that I don't know that much about because it's very New York centric, but it's really different from the scene down here. But like here has a lot of familiar faces who've been working on records up there for many, many, many years. And John is right in that scene and he's been in that scene for decades. Anyway, Sean Colvin's debut album was called Steady On and it was a big success. And John had a huge hand in making that with her. And they collaborated again in 1996 on A Few Small Repairs, which was her biggest album to date. And I'm pretty sure it's probably her biggest album ever. It had Sunny Came Home and all those big hits on it. He also made Jim Lauderdale's first record. And man, those are actually some pretty serious first records. I don't know about you guys out there, but the first records I made were really crappy. you know, especially for sort of a late bloomer like John, who didn't really... Apparently, he didn't have an electric guitar at all until he was in college. Anyway, he's made a ton of amazing records for artists like Sean Colvin, of course, and William Bell, Mark Cohen, Sarah Jarosz, Rodney Crowell, and of course, a whole slew of great ones with his wife, Roseanne Cash. He's written songs for Tedeschi Trucks, Vince Gill, George Strait, Patti Loveless, and he's racked up 6 Grammy Awards in the process. Not too shabby. John tours a lot with Roseanne Cash, and that's where you're likely to see him out there more than anything else. I also had the really good fortune to see him do a super cool show with Roseanne and Ry Cooter and Joaquin Cooter doing all Johnny Cash tunes. That was a pretty sweet show. I loved it. I don't think they did that many of them. So John has a solo record coming out, and in fact, it's his debut solo album. And it's not going to be out for a little while still, but I got my mitts on it and it's a killer record. So we do talk about it here quite a bit, but you won't be able to hear it until the fall, probably, maybe earlier than that. I'm not sure, but watch for it. It's called Rumble Strip under his own name, John Leventhal. And he doesn't have a website as of right now, but he's on Instagram as, I think it's John N. Leventhal. So that's John N. Leventhal. So you can get little snippets of his killer playing on there. And that's about the only place you can find him. So with that, please enjoy my conversation with John Leventhal. Well, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's cool I was able to track you down through my old buddy, Craig Northey there.
Yeah, yeah. Small world.
Yeah, indeed. Are you at home? I am, yeah.
Okay. So I have, I don't know, around 2015-ish, I built a studio. I bought a townhouse in Chelsea like 27 years ago. And for many years, some reason, I thought I needed to go somewhere to work, which was, I realized, sort of foolish. The bottom line is, yeah, I have a studio on the ground floor of our townhouse here in Chelsea. So it's
oh, wow, just, okay.
Yeah, I did it 6 or 7 years ago. I should have done it 27 years ago. Who knew?
So what's the setup there? I can see a bunch of guitars and instruments. Are we
going to gear right away?
No, I don't really delve into gear that much, but like, is it one room or do you have like a little bit?
So it's 1,000 square feet, which, you know, for New York isn't bad.
Yeah.
Ceilings could be a little higher, but, I don't know how much you heard before. So yeah, like 6 or 7 years ago, my daughter was living down here and she moved out. And the lease was up on a space that I had been renting with my partner at the time. And I said, come on, let's just build a studio. With what we'll pay in this lease in 2 or 3 years, we can build a studio. And that turned out to be true. And the studio is just great. I just love it. Like I say, I really wish I had done it 2 decades at least ago. And I have a control room with all the gear and a lot of guitars, and a lot of time is spent here. I work with vocalists here, and but I also have a live room.
Oh, you do?
B3, lots of guitar amps, piano, whirlies and stuff. And then I have a sort of a wood paneled hallway that's wired up, and then I have like a B room, a smaller room in the front. Yeah, so I have like,
wow, that's
pretty, yeah,
that's
pretty
legit.
Functional. Yeah, and I've been doing every record, any record I've done in the last 6 years, 7 years I've done here. So
okay.
It's great. I can do everything. I have string sections, horn sections, it's all good.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so up to that point, like seven years ago or whatever, did you have a permanent rental somewhere that you were working out of?
Yeah. I did. Yeah.
And that was in Manhattan as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, you know, I've been doing this for a while. So I started Analog Tape and when the computer thing sort of made it feasible, or yeah, actually even a step before that with ADATS, a buddy of mine sort of found a studio space because I had an intuition, which is, I think, essentially proved to be right, that I would do better work if I had my own space and wasn't always watching the clock. And I mean, there's something to be said for watching the clock. We can talk about that. But in the grand scheme of things, for what I think that my skill set was, it was really good to have my own space.
Yeah, absolutely. So that place that you had, were you sharing it with somebody or were you sharing it with
a bunch
of people?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, with a really good buddy of mine who has sadly passed away. His name is Rick DePoffy. Passed away. Sort of, he built the studio for me and then sadly passed away.
Oh, man.
Really talented guy, super, really actually deeply musical cat, but also, you know, really sort of an autodidact when it came to electronics and recording, and really knew a lot and knew about, you know, sussed out building studio. I mean, he was a good partner.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
filled a lot of gaps and shit that I never wanted to deal with. So it was great.
So did you have to deal with a lot of soundproofing issues living in a townhouse in Chelsea? That seems like,
you know,
amazing that you can pull off what you're doing there.
Yeah, but not any more than anybody else has to do. Well, first of all, okay. Everybody in my family's a musician, so everybody understands, so that's helpful, right?
Yeah.
It's not like I married a neurosurgeon who has to get up at 4 a.m. every morning. So, although, you know, that might have been interesting.
Yeah.
No, it's fairly well soundproofed. I mean, the live room is a room within a room, which is, you know, what in New York anyway is what you got to do. Even if I was in a commercial building, it's what you'd have to do.
Yeah.
And that's great. I mean, my son's also in the biz. He does what I do. He's quite talented and he's quite busy and he's been working here a lot too. I mean, he plays a lot harder and louder than I do. So we hear it, but it doesn't, you know, man, it just doesn't bother us. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not allowed, you know, particularly the years have gone on, I noticed that, you know, the amps get softer, and, you know, my touch gets lighter. So the compression gets lighter. So there you go.
Have you got into any of those, like the aux or anything like that allow you to record electrics?
Nah, I never cared about any of that stuff. I have great amps and, you know, I really don't want to end up sounding like, okay, boomer, although would be totally illegitimate. You know, I'm in about myself. No, but you know, I started basically by having a guitar and a cable and you plug it into an amp and, you know, tried to make music. So that's what I'm comfortable with. I totally get and appreciate that cats can make great sounds out of it and do sessions. That's fine. It's totally cool. It's just not, I'm just not that interested in it. So
I understand completely. This new record of yours, can we talk about that? Like, what's the situation with it? When's it coming out?
I don't have a release date, you know, so I sort of just decided to pull the trigger on this a couple of months ago. So much to my surprise, the entire industry isn't sort of like dancing to my tune. So I think I have a place to release it. You know, it's just everything takes time. So, I mean, if I just kind of wanted to put it out there, sure, I could put it out there next week. But I think, you know, I may have found like a label and I'm looking for a publicist. So, you know, if I went through all the trouble of doing it, I might as well release it in some sort of semi-coherent way. So it'll be out this year, probably in the second half of the year.
Okay.
Well, you know, I've sent it to a bunch of my friends. So it's also, of course, the problem with that is that I thought I was done. And now I'm right before you and I talked, I noticed I was recording one more tune that I think jam on there. So we'll see what happens. Yeah.
So do you want to talk about it, or do you want to keep that project under wraps for now? Because this will probably come out in February. So,
I mean, no, man, let's talk about it. I like talking about music. We can talk about my record. We can talk about other records. Talk about records I've done. Talk about records that we love. I don't care. It's all good to me, man.
Let's talk about all that stuff. But I did, like, you sent me the record, and it's called Rumble Strip. And I'd love to talk to you about it because I think it's a fantastic record.
Thank you.
Yeah, people will be a little in the dark because they won't be able to hear it probably until a few months after this comes out. But screw them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's good marketing to say screw them, but say, we love you. We hope you'll like it. Right.
This will just whet their appetite for months on end.
Hopefully.
But can you tell me a bit about how you did this record? Like, I think you play, I did see the credits. There's a PDF that you sent me with it that have credits, and it seems like you played pretty much everything, maybe aside from some horns or something. So I assume that was all done in your place there?
Sure.
I didn't even know that you played piano, really, but there's some really beautiful keyboard stuff on there that piano that kicks the record off. What's the song called? Floyd Kramer's Dream.
Floyd Kramer's Dream, yeah.
What a crazy sound that is. Is that piano detuned or something?
No, but it has a felt mute in it, which is pretty wacky. Yeah. And you put the mic pretty far away and the felt mute just, you know, starts to create something that's kind of weird. You know, man, I mean, I didn't do it in any big radical way differently. Over the last, let's say, decade. Oh, man, what is the short-winded answer here? You know, when I first started making records, I sort of did it the way that most people do it, which is hired a bunch of musicians, went into a studio. Sometimes I would play, sometimes I wouldn't play. Quite often I had written the tune and, you know, so I had probably done demos that had some sort of compelling thing for me, hopefully in the artist. And, you know, and so I did that process. This is all sort of pre-home or pre-releasable home recording technology. I actually had a Tascam 4-track and I had a Tascam 8-track. So I was making demos. And then somewhere along the line, I started shifting. I've always had a facility on instruments. And then, of course, I've basically spent the last, not quite half century, but, you know, moving toward a half century in recording studio. So I've been around a lot of instruments, and it's in my nature to make noise on them and stuff. And, you know, I have an understanding of harmony and all this. So it's, you know, so I can, like you said, I didn't know you play keyboards. Well, I'm not a particularly adept keyboard player, but I understand music. And so I understand things to do on the piano that to me are musical. So, you know, I'm not sitting there being Keith Jarrett or Bruce Hornsby, but, you know, I understand, I have kind of a harmonic understanding and I know how to like pluck it out and sort of create music that for me has some feeling. So yeah, I play a lot of instruments, and over the years, so that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, over the years I've noticed on records, I play a lot of the instruments. Now, was it a conscious choice to do that? Yes, at one point it was, and I've just kind of flowed with it. And I don't know if it's better than having session cat. I mean, this is, for me, a potentially deep, complicated conversation about hiring musicians or not hiring musicians and what it means and what musicians bring to recording sessions and music and preconceived ideas, and everybody, including myself, brings ideas that have worked in the past. And sometimes for me, when I play everything, I force myself not to do what's worked in the past just because I'm not, it doesn't appeal to me all that much to repeat my ideas all the time.
I understand.
Right. So it's a little bit of a head game. You know, I have a strong internal critic. I try to pay attention to it. I try not to have it like, you know, depress me or anything, but, you know, so it's just all, it's a high wire act, man. I'm balancing knives and spoons and sure. guitars and, you know, just trying to make music that feels meaningful and has some emotional content. And it doesn't feel like I'm just rehashing either my ideas or somebody else's ideas. You know, you don't always get it, but it's sort of the fuel that moves me forward, I've noticed. Anyway, the bottom line is I've been doing a lot where I've been playing everything and, you know, sort of stuck here during the pandemic. So I really had no choice. And this sort of making this solo record was sort of, you know, some ways looming over me for a few years because I noticed as the years go by, you know, I tend to write with a lot of artists and there's just so many ideas that never find a home and I ain't getting any younger. And the pandemic came. So it's almost like a sign that I couldn't ignore, which is, well, dude. You know,
it's time.
If you're ever going to do it, you need to confront it. So I confronted it and, you know, I recorded probably I write all the time. So it's not like I sat down, I'm going to write for my solo record. I'm always writing. So I just, and, you know, writing is one thing, but making a record that's your statement, like with me as the artist, was a little weird, for me because I'm incredibly comfortable, you know, producing and writing for and working behind and arranging for other people. But, you know, when it was like, well, what is it you really have to say that has any, that's worthwhile in any way? That was a little challenging for me. Anyway, the bottom line is I wrote a bunch of stuff, got rid of a good portion of it, kept what you heard. And I thought, well, this has got something and whatever it is, I don't know what it all adds up to, but it's me. So there you go.
I would imagine that, there, you know, you, as you mentioned, you're sort of a tough critic on yourself. You've had a career that's like 40 to 50 years at this point, and this is the first time you've done a solo record. That's a lot of pressure, man. Do you think you would have?
I felt it.
Do you think you would have done this?
I really created sort of an existential like vortex for myself to like.
No doubt.
Yeah, make myself feel miserable for sure. Yeah.
Do you think that this would have happened if the pandemic hadn't sort of brought forth this time to dive in and focus on your own stuff?
It's a really good question. I don't really have the answer, but I suspect it's possible it wouldn't have. I regret that it took an international painful crisis to motivate me to do the thing that I knew in a kind of, not to get too sort of highfalutin, but there was sort of a spiritual element to like just confronting this and doing it and following through on it and releasing it. It's just sort of something I understood for myself that I just needed to do to show myself that I could do it. Now, why hadn't I done it earlier? Because I'm not a compelling singer. I wouldn't want to, if I had to sit through like 12 songs of me singing, I'd be like, no, I'm not doing that. So, you know, I sing on every record I produce pretty much, but it's never been like, here's Leventhal, he's going to sing, you know? So, you know, it took a little bit of experimenting and understanding to sort of figure out what I was comfortable to hear myself singing. Now, why did I bother to sing? It was just another thing where it's just like, just do it, Matt. Like, it was just a thing I needed to do.
I think it sounds great.
Yeah, well, thanks. I had some great collaborators, so that always helps. So
that does help, yeah. So on something like the title track, Rumble Strip, it's a real groove piece, and that's something that I think is kind of a hallmark of your productions, too, is like real strong groove. Like, I know that for you, you know, things that you've probably been influenced by is like, you know, country and soul and R&B and blues and funk and Motown and all this stuff. And I hear that in what you're doing, but not like directly. And on a tune like that, it's very groove based. And I'm really curious how you, first of all, wrote a song like that by yourself. And then how you did, like, what was the process for you for recording? Did you do the drums first or was it like a guitar first thing? Or what was that process like?
Well, there was amber fluid involved.
Okay. That helps.
Well, you know, the pandemic was a weird, you know, it was weird. And our kid, our youngest kid was in college. So it was just me and Roseanne were here in the house. So, and she would tend to go to bed early. And, you know, I gave myself license to sort of, I mean, part, like a song like that, you know, I mean, I'm happy to talk about this. I'll be shocked if anybody gives a shit, but.
Oh, they'll give a shit.
I mean, a song like part of it for me was, like I say, I've been producing records for a long time, and I have within me a tendency to want to orchestrate and organize and arrange. Like, it's just part of my musical DNA. Like, there's a thing in me, and it's a good thing, because I think it's in part what led me to being a record producer, right? Which is, I have an arranger sensibility. So I'm sort of wired to take music and try to organize it. And now that I've been making records for so long, I'm wired to take it in and organize it as a record. Like, oh, how can you make a record out of this? You know? So part of this quote unquote solo record, and particularly the track you're talking about, it's part of this thing. It's hard for me to quite articulate it, but of this thing that I don't want to repeat myself, and trying to put myself in situations where I don't get to rely on my old standbys. And mm-hmm. So that's what that song was. It wasn't written. It was like, I came down, I poured myself a whiskey. I started playing a little incredibly simple two-note guitar thing. And I was like, oh, that has so much space to it. And, oh, well, the space could groove. And then I heard the groove in my head. So the way my studio is constructed or wired is that when we built it, the only thing I said was, I just want pretty much everything ready to go. Whoa, sorry about that. It's a track I'm working. So at any moment I have mics. I have two beautiful 67s for vocals and acoustic Ooh. Guitars. I have other mics for acoustic guitars literally right next to me. I have my P bass set up. I have an upright, like 10 feet away. In the live room, I have the drum set. Everything's mic'd. Everything has their own discrete pre. There's a signal chain to every mic, and I can just flip a switch and I can go in and play drums just like that. Like, if you were to say, go play drums right now, I could just walk in and record drums. I wouldn't have to spend 8 minutes, 9 minutes, 12 minutes, 13 minutes setting it up. You know, the only thing I might have to do is, oh, you know, maybe I should turn the compression down on the overheads or whatever, because they're hitting too hard. So basically in that tune, I found one incredibly simple riff, I guess the riff that starts it. And I said, oh, I like that. And I heard the groove, and I went and what I did is I went and played it, probably played 16, 32 bars, found, you know, the 8 bars that felt good, because I didn't want to spend a lot of time. I didn't want to get analytical about it. That's part of my thing. Like, a lot of my work is I do my best work if I avoid getting analytical and arrangement oriented too soon, right? Because I know I have that skill set. I can always go. So I found a little groove, boom, 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 boom. I just chopped it up. So that feels good. It's probably 4 bars. Chopped it up, looped it. And then I just started, turn the computer on and rolled, turn the mics on. I think it was a nylon string guitar, put a little reverb on it. And I just played for like 10 minutes. And, you know, 80% of what I thought should be there was there. I think maybe I had to go back and create a little segue section to get the theme to come back at the end. But that's the easy part. And then I just played a second guitar. I was like, oh, this is good. You know, I probably played, you know, I'm just like, you know, sure, sometimes I get lucky and it's all the first take. But, you know, it was probably a couple of 2 or 3 takes and I comped the best of it.
Yeah.
And then I probably played upright. And I think on that, I decided I should go back and play the drums for real and play all the hits. And I said, nah, I like it. It was a kind of a trance-like thing. So that worked for me too. And it was done. Boom. Awesome. I probably got most of it down in one night. Probably took 3 hours, maybe 4 hours. And then, you know, I probably cleaned it up the next day. And that's what you hear.
So that's a pretty efficient process. It sounds like, were you?
Yeah, it's not always efficient like that. Because it wasn't written, it felt natural, if that makes sense. As opposed to something I'm composing, I'm like, oh, no, that chord's wrong. You know, that chord's just not working or whatever.
So are there some songs on the record that are more like that, where you kind of struggled with them or like spent way more time?
Yeah. Well, the ones I really struggled with, you don't get to hear.
Right.
Because I hate them. Sure, man. There's tons. I mean, I have to... I don't have the song list in front of me, but sure, there's tons of songs. Like, there's that.
If someone's going to hang you up, is it like the lyrics or more of a guitar part or a melody? Or what's your Achilles heel as a writer if you have
Steve,
one?
It's not black and white like that for me. I don't experience it like that. I don't experience music like that. I don't know. It just sounds corny, but I think for me anyway, it's true. Does it feel substantially compelling? Does it feel worthwhile? I mean, we're living in a time sort of, and I want to say this with all humility, because there's so many talented people. You know, it's like everybody's kind of learned how to build the house, man. You know, it's like there's a lot of music out there and everybody has some mad skill sets on every level, recording, playing, chops, you know, writing, I mean, grooves. It's like, so it's just a question of like if it feels worthwhile to me or whether it feels like, well, I did this because I could do it and it's not bad, you know, but I guess what it is, looking just for some little spark of magic and what I feel is magic. Next person may not feel it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But for me, like I say, I have this sort of internal barometer or critic, whatever you want to call it. And it's just basically looking for what I feel is a little bit of real feeling or magic. You know,
I get it.
That's
I get it.
It.
So on a piece like Tullamore Blues, which is another one off the new record, what draws me into that is like the overall sound and the texture of the guitar or guitars. And there's a really mysterious quality to it. Like I'm a guitar player and I can pick out what's what usually, but like, it definitely sounds like an acoustic guitar, but then it also sounds like an electric guitar and there's a tiny bit of tremolo going on there. So what's going on? And is that a textural, like multiple guitar thing that I'm not hearing distinctly different guitar parts, or how are you doing all that stuff?
I think on that, of course, I could be proved right. I'd have to go listen to it. I actually haven't listened to this in a bit. I think Tullamore Blues was pretty straight ahead. But you are hearing this thing you're describing on many other tunes, which I will now explain to you. I've explained it in a lot of interviews. So I do feel like I'm repeating myself. But I think Tullamore Blues is pretty straight ahead. It's just, once again, that was composed on the spot. And I have a really nice, well, actually, I don't even know if it's nice. It's just a beat to hell LOO.
Okay.
That I haven't changed the strings on well over a decade. You know, so if I play it with my thumb and I play it lightly and the mics are wide open, it just sort of seems to have a character.
Yeah.
And on a song like that, for me, it's sort of like, I think what I'm doing is sort of the opposite of what most people are doing lately, which is I'm trying not to fill a lot of space. Mm-hmm. Right. So some of these tunes on this record, not all, but some of them are me, you know, consciously playing with space and letting the space between the notes have some purpose. Now that sounds kind of highfalutin, but that's actually the way I think about it, you know? So, I think on Tullamore Blues, I think it's pretty straight ahead. I just think it's one acoustic guitar plays the melody in the first half. And then I play on a Telecaster, I play the melody in the second half. I think it's pretty straight ahead, I think.
Where's the tremolo coming in then in the acoustic guitar sound?
Is there, God, on that track, I'd have to listen to it. Okay, so, well, this will be interesting. And like I say, I don't think there's tremolo on that track, but then again, really? I could be wrong. Or, man, I could do anything. I mean, I'm not above
it's sending subtle.
I'm not above sending a signal, like sending, a signal from the guitar track to some reverb. And then I'm not above taking that reverb and putting the reverb through tremolo. I mean, I've done that.
Maybe that's what it is then.
Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely process reverb, turn off high end, change the pans. Yeah, I'll do something so that it's almost more of a psychoacoustic phenomenon than you're going like, oh, there's the tremolo on the guitar. But on a lot of other tracks, like if you listen closely, particularly the solo acoustic guitar tracks, like I've been doing this thing forever, which is I have a sound hole pickup in a lot of my acoustics. And I just run that through some pedals, a little delay, a little tremolo into a Fender amp in the other room. And I just sort of blend that behind the acoustic signal just to sort of give it a little kinetic energy. So, and not trying to make it sound lo-fi or anything bullshit like that, but just sort of to give it just a little energy, just a little something. So it's not just, oh, beautiful acoustic guitar sound. Not that there's anything wrong with a beautiful acoustic guitar sound, but there you go.
So when you're doing solo acoustic stuff in your place and you're engineering it, are you just sitting there in front of your computer or do you go back into another room? And
like this? No, okay. I'm literally sitting in this space. I've got, well, you can't see it, but I've got a world of microphones here.
Oh, let's see it. Oh, well, look at that.
Yeah. So, well, you know, many years ago, before I had my own studios, I used to work a lot at Sears Sound. I don't know if you know about Sears Sound or Walter Sear in New York. It's a great little studio. I was there forever. Walter was amazing. A lot of great anecdotes. I cut Sonny Came Home there, whatever. Walter actually helped me get my mic collection. He's no longer with us anymore. But the one thing Walter, mentioned was like, you know, put some plastic bags on those mics when you're not using them. Dust will kill them, you know? So I've been putting plastic bags. I make my son here. It's like, I don't see the plastic. Where's the plastic bag? No. Particularly on the good mics, on the 67s.
Yeah.
And stuff like
yeah.
That. So I stay. I basically hang right here and do pretty much everything. I haven't heard it yet, but I know you did an interview with Sarah. She'll tell you how. She refers to it as my spaceship, where I basically stay in this one chair and pretty much except for the drums, I can get everything done. So
production wise, like very like sweeping generalization through your entire career, you've kind of seen the whole gamut of like the industry. Like when you started making records, it would have been in the late 80s. And there was, you know, budgets were different. Studios were different. The mentality of recording was way different. Do you have any kind of general feelings about the job of being a music producer and how it's changed for you over the years? Because those are some drastic shifts. And I'd like to talk specifically about some of those early records too and how you got into it in the first place. But now that you're here making them at home, it's a completely different vibe from how you would have started. Do you find that exciting and interesting? Or is it like, I don't know, how does that strike you as a person deeply involved in it?
Yeah, it's a good conversation and it's worthy of me being mildly articulate, and I'm not sure I can be, but let's see, because it goes to a fairly deep place of me. And I really, really don't want to say anything that feels, you know, cranky old man, or I don't, because I see the validity in whatever time I'm working in, right?
Yep.
Even the 80s, which I always felt out of place in the 80s, even though it's when I started, I never felt connected to the music in the 80s. So I see the validity of what everybody's doing. Okay, what is the thing? Well, first of all, look, man, we could go down a rabbit hole here. There's just so much more product now that's just off the charts. It's just everybody, you know, people are born with computers in their fingers and, you know, guitars on their laps by the time they're three. And, you know, people can make records, you know, pretty quickly. My son, who happens to be really talented, and of course, I'm proud of him. And I probably wouldn't say that out loud if I didn't think he was. He's talented. You know, he kind of got the gist of it when he was like 18, right? He's 24 now. So he's got the grasp of it. So there's a lot more out there. When I first started, I made my living as a record producer. That's what I did for a living. I was also a songwriter, luckily, and I played on, you know, I did sessions and stuff, although primarily, I think when people think of me, they think of me as a record producer.
Yeah.
I don't make my living as a record producer anymore. So that, in some fundamental way, is the main difference. And because I don't make my living as a record producer, it has lots of tentacles and permutations about how I feel about it practically, how I feel about it musically, how I feel about it spiritually, you know. I've made in the last 5 or 6 years records that I think have been very well received, won Grammys, but I didn't really make any money on them, right? Now, this is not about money, man. It's just about trying to understand who you are, where you are, what you're doing, what's valuable, what do you want to do, what's meaningful to you. You know, and luckily I'm in a position where maybe I have at this point, because I've had a long career, I've had a certain degree of success. I have choices, maybe choices other people don't have. Lucky me, no question about it. But what's changed for me is I don't feel compelled to just produce just for the sake of producing, because it's what I do. You know, I go out with my wife. We have a band, we have a great band. We also do a lot of shows as a duo. We go out with a duo for a weekend. I make more than I make playing a record, even a record, a mildly well-budgeted record. So it just sort of reorients my priorities. And basically what it reorients into is like, I just really want to make good music. I love making records. But I mean, I took a couple of years off because I needed to confront my solo record, yeah, which was quite a journey. And then luckily, Roseanne and I got hired to write a score for a musical. So I haven't actually produced a record since Sarah DeRose's record, which is right before the pandemic. So it was at 2020. So over 2 years, I haven't produced a record. And now I can see that I'm drifting back to it because I miss it. But I want to make records that I like, that are moving to me, not just to do it as a gig. If so, that's the basic change. I don't do it as a gig anymore. I do it like, because it's just an opportunity to really make some good music. So
do you turn a lot of stuff down?
I can't say my phone. I mean, there was a minute, I think, you know, no, my phone's not burning up. Do I turn stuff down? Yeah. But it's not like I'm getting called like every other day to produce records. I mean, I get called for sure, but I don't turn a lot down. I turn some stuff down. I'm trying to keep an open mind about it too. You know, it's like, I'm forcing myself not to stay in a box that would be very easy for me to stay in, because I like my box.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like I'm very heavily influenced by 1960s and early 1970s music. I'm incredibly influenced by it, and it's comfortable. I like it. But, you know, I try to put a little bit of effort into not just getting stultified into like this thing. I don't know, man. You know what I mean, right?
I do. So, yeah. So with the Sarah DeRose thing is interesting because obviously, like, she's coming to you as an established artist. That's the kind of project that would have at least a budget to work in a, you know, in a big studio and that kind of thing. But you opted to do it in your home studio, obviously, because you're comfortable and all your gear is there, and I totally get that. Do you ever, like, what would it take to get you into a big studio in New York or LA or something these days to make a record, or would you just not do that anymore?
An interesting question. I don't think it would take much. It would just take the right artist and the right project with a vision for how it would be worthwhile to go into a big studio with a certain other set of players other than myself or my super core group of people in New York. It would just take the right project. It just hasn't come to me. I mean, I'm not like super active searching for it. I mean, I have one idea for a big project that there's just no universe in which it could be done here. And I almost hesitate to talk about it because I'm not sure it's going to happen, but it would be a big project, require like at least a small string orchestra and some horns, and you know, and my vision would be to do it on the floor, late 50s style, and do it that way. I mean, I would have to have the arrangements like really together, and I'd have to really, I've actually been subtly looking for the right session players for about 5 years to do this. It's not actually that easy to do this thing I want to do. Right. So, and yeah, that's another thing. It's like session players, I'm not super knowledgeable about the current crop, so I probably shouldn't weigh in on any level, but it seems there's a kind of different aesthetic now as a result of computers, and particularly in Nashville, the way records tend to be made. And I mean, I'm still very much coming from, can you create a part? Okay, I get all this noodling and stuff, but I don't want to sit here for 90 minutes trying to sort through your noodling to see if I can create a part. So I mean, that, I don't, I mean, whatever, one of my skill sets, hopefully, I think, is that I can recognize when somebody's playing something like, oh, that's good. Let's capture that little two bar off. Let's make it, can you complete the phrase? It's a four bar phrase. Nice. Let's get it nice and tuned. Get your time. Sit back. Boom, 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 boom. Hey, play that over here too. Like that, that's the way my mind works. And I notice that seems a little more challenging for cats these days. Like a lot of cats aren't quite wired for that and they get frustrated. Whereas I feel like when I started, if you couldn't do that, you didn't work. Period. End of story, right? It's like end of story. I mean, I've played on whatever. I'm not saying this to name drop. You know, I played on this Edie Brickell record that Paul Simon produced. You know, it's like, and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, that, you had to be able to like focus and organize your shit. Or yeah. I played on the Bruce Hornsby record once, you know, like where we spend a day on like a 12 bar, you know, just like, you know, really like getting, nailing the bad boy. So I think that that aesthetic, and maybe to a certain degree it's good, but I don't know, man. It's like, I try not to judge it. I just think I have a certain aesthetic and I'd have to find the right group of cats to roll down the road with me. They're out there, man. I just, just lazy, just haven't found.
Okay, so can we go back to like your early days? Because that's something that there's very little information out there on. I would imagine as a kid you played in bands, and I don't know if you did touring and stuff, but when you first come out of the gate, you come out swinging because you produce a record that's super successful for Sean Colvin. I think that's, as far as I can tell, that's the first record you produced, right?
Yeah, it is.
Tell me, like, I guess, like, first of all, what got you into music in the first place? But like, what led you to that path of producing? Were you doing a ton of sessions and stuff that are just sort of under the radar, or how did you get into that racket in the first place?
No, good questions. I'm going to try to be super succinct because we're really talking about like a 10-year period.
Yeah.
Before I make that record with Colvin. So. I'm a bit of a late bloomer. I didn't buy my first electric guitar until my senior year of college.
Whoa. Were you in college for?
For absolutely no reason at all. I studied literature at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
You know, man, look, where I grew up, there wasn't a clear path to becoming a professional musician, or certainly not a professional pop, rock, country, Americana. You know, to my parents, I was an alien. I mean, I love my parents. They love me, but they never could understand what the hell was going on.
Where did you grow up? Where were you?
I grew up in right outside of Manhattan. I grew up like 20 miles north here.
Oh, okay.
And so for me, like a lot of other people, I mean, I've said this too in interviews, but so I'm going to try to make it quick. Yeah, I mean, it's the Beatles. Like the Beatles hit, I hear Love Me Do, I hear I'll Be Back, and I'm transported. It's not transported in anything remotely like an analytical way. I'm transported. It's magic. It's just, I'm feeling things I don't understand. I feel yearning. I want to hear it again. It becomes infused into who I am and every part of my life. It's not like I'm sitting there trying to understand it. It just is. And everything changed. But I didn't quite have the scope at that time, the talent or anything around me to indicate that I could somehow
become that.
It's hard to explain unless you kind of grew up where I did at the time.
Did you have ambitions to be like in a rock band that was super successful or not?
No,
really?
I think maybe I'm kind of weird. It's like, no, I didn't. I mean, I think I secretly, as I went to college, well, first of all, I wasn't very talented. So I've never been, I mean, I'm not delusional about myself. Like I said, I have a very strong internal critic. I had it when I was 14 too. It's not like I've developed it. So I knew I wasn't talented. I mean, I knew I didn't have what needed to be had. I mean, that was clear to me. I'd go hear, you know, the bands playing around in my hometown or whatever. And it's like, man, I love them all, but I knew like I wasn't good enough to play in them.
But that's not true, probably. Like,
no,
how is that possible?
It is true. No, I'll tell you when it happened. All right, here's the short version. I think I said this, gave this whole sad story to Zach Childs in one of his interviews. Basically, the bottom line is I was going to college. I really didn't have any vision for my future. I was going to probably apply to law school. I would have been a friggin' miserable lawyer. And I decided to take a year off. I bought an electric guitar. I knew nothing about guitars. I bought an ES-335 page of the Madison newspaper for $140. Why did I buy it? I bought it probably because I saw the shape and BB played it and I didn't know, you know, it's like, oh, okay, okay. Long story short, I took a year off and that year has turned out to be close to 50 years. So it was the best decision I've ever made.
Best year of your life.
Yeah. So I played around with some friends. We went out Colorado and tried to be, you know, a band, you know, like we didn't know what the fuck we were doing. We had no idea what we were doing. And at some point I'm playing and I'm starting to get, I'm you know, playing guitar and I'm starting to pay attention and I'm starting to listen to it. And I'm like, oh, well, okay. Like starting to get this general idea of like what you need to do to become a better guitar player. And then the realization, oh God, they're session guitar players. And, you know, all this is starting to come into me as I'm sitting in Colorado. So after 2 years, I said, well, I'm going to go move back home. And I moved back home, lived with my parents for a couple of years, miserable couple of years. However, within the first year, I just had a big birthday party and we had a lot of people here, 62 people. And part of why I wanted to do that is that I'm astonished at my life. I'm astonished at the sequence of things that have happened to me that have just, if I hadn't met A, I wouldn't have met B, I wouldn't have met C, wouldn't have met C, you know, ultimately not meeting my wife and having my kids and just like that kind of thing. So I was really lucky. There was a guy in my hometown. His name was Billy Vera. He's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He had this band, Billy and the Beaters in L.A.
Sure.
In the 80s. But I'm talking like mid-late 70s here. And he worked all the time.
He lived in the same town that you grew up in?
Yeah, I lived in this county, Westchester County,
okay.
Which is literally right next door to New York City. And he had a band. He worked all the time. I was the kid in the band. And I wasn't very good. But the band was great. Bass player was phenomenal. It was this guy named Tommy Woke, became T-Bone Woke.
T-Bone Woke, yeah.
At SNL. He was a really good friend of mine. And he was really, really good musician. And so I learned a lot. Played in that band for 2.5, 3 years. And we didn't play for audiences. We played for people to dance in bars. And they did dance. And Billy was amazing. And we played from every conceivable genre of music there was. Old rock and roll, old R&B, soul, country music, jump band stuff. It was everything. And it was a little bit where I understood what I needed to do in order to be good. And Billy split. And then really almost right away, I met Sean Colvin. And I met another extraordinary group of musicians. Because I had moved to Manhattan and who was in Manhattan? Larry Campbell, Tony Garnier, okay. Played with Dylan forever, Colvin, yeah. Buddy Miller, Jim Lauderdale. So there, God damn, I'm so sorry. This track keeps going. Let me quit. Sorry. My little Burt Bacharach track. Hold on.
Was there sort of like an open mic scene or something? Or like, where did you meet Sean Colvin?
No, there was just a lot of places to play, man.
Okay.
You know, there was just tons of clubs in the city in the 80s. Tons, lots.
Yep.
I worked 4 or 5 nights a week. I made more playing in clubs in the 80s than any you guys make now. You know, I worked for $100, $150 a night. I was working 4 or 5 nights a week in the 80s. My rent was $240 a month. I was
amazing.
It was fine. And then you do that and you start doing sessions. I did a million demo-y sessions. I went out on the road with this guy, Steve Forbert. Probably still around. Yeah. So how
did the session thing come about? Like that doesn't just,
you know,
fall
just
into
like it
people's
comes about
lives.
For anybody, like anybody just playing around. And you know, there was a million at that point, there was tons of studios in Manhattan. They're not
okay.
Anymore.
Right.
You know, and just playing everything. But apart from the session thing, Steve, I think the thing that was slightly different for me was at the same time I was doing all this, I was always writing songs.
This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use iZotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to iZotope.com/soulpod, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra-tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Also, thanks to Ear Trumpet Labs, a workshop in Portland, Oregon, hand-building amazing-sounding microphones. These large diaphragm condensers combine state-of-the-art sound with eye-catching designs and the feedback control to excel live as well as in the studio. I am using their Edwina myself right now on this podcast. Check them out at eartrumpetlabs.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang. It's a four-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville on September 19th to 22nd, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right, then, let's get back to the show.
Like, part and parcel with learning how to be a musician and be in a band, I was writing songs. I've said this in an interview, too. It's like the first three chords I learned on the guitar. Great, I learned the three chords and I wrote a song with them. And I feel like whatever it is that I have as a musician, I don't know, whatever my touch or sensibility is, it's that I've always been, I think I'm better at coming up with a compelling chord sequence than playing hot, interesting licks. Like, that's just kind of who I am. So that's always served me well because it let me understand what my role was in any situation I was in, as opposed to, you know, which we probably all recognize, there's just a lot of cats who just want to play. They're just going to play, yeah. And you know, and that was never my thing. My thing was always to kind of hold back and look for cracks and find a moment and craft a two-note thing that I could repeat. And I was just always wired to do that. So anyway, the bottom line is, like anybody else, I just was writing songs, playing a lot, doing sessions. I met Colvin and Lauderdale, and I wrote songs with both of them over the course of a few years. And then both with Sean and Jim, toward the mid-80s, we started to find our voices as writers. Like, I think with Sean and I, I've said before, like in the beginning, like maybe we were like thinking like, oh, let's write some kind of hit, but we were never meant to do that. And then we both started finding our voice. And I had a little demo set up. I had a little Tascam 8-track. I'd make the demos. And then eventually, those demos got around. Colvin got a deal. I produced that. And Lauderdale got a deal. And I ended up co-producing that. And that was it. All of a sudden, I was a record producer. It wasn't as though, for all this decade building up to that moment, that I was like, man, I really want to be a record producer. No, I just wanted to be a good musician and I wanted to write songs. And if the opportunity came for me to arrange and or produce the songs I wrote, then I'd be really happy. And that's kind of all I really ever wanted to do.
It seems to me kind of odd that in that era, like the late 80s, that they would give someone like you a crack at producing a record for a newly signed artist.
Yeah, it wasn't. Well, the demos are pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to say, for both those guys, the demos are pretty good. In fact, a lot of time on those first two records was spent in big, expensive studios with session players trying to recapture the magic of the demos, which was something I made note of, right? As I went along, it's like, if there's a way to capture the initial magic on the demos and be able to release them. So the technology had not quite caught, was not quite there then, but eventually it did. I think I'm not patting myself in the back. The demos were pretty good. And I don't want to say they were undeniable, but they were probably undeniable. And of course, Colvin was amazing. And Lauderdale, in his own way, his own goofy way, was amazing.
Yeah. They're both fantastic artists. Deals.
Yeah. And,
So was it a situation where like Sean Colvin and Jim Lauderdale signed deals and it was like you had the gig, or did you have to kind of like fight for it, or did you have to sell yourself to anybody, or did organically happen?
My memory cells are not all intact. With Jim, it was easy. It was too easy because Rodney Crowell heard the demo and wanted to produce them. And then he's like, well, who did the demos? And Jim said, well, you know, my buddy John. And I think Sean's record had already been out. So he clocked the two and he said, well, John, let's have John produce it with us. So I co-produced it with Ronnie. So that was pretty easy. And the thing with Sean, no, it wasn't like immediately it's a complicated story how I ended up producing it. There's a one or two kind of dumbass music business unpleasant things, and I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. So let's just say that no, it wasn't. They weren't falling over themselves to give me the gig, but eventually okay. It made sense for me to get the gig, and you know, it worked out. I was definitely the guy to do it. Written them, you know, it's like I had already arranged it on the demo, so it was
so fun. Had some people been hired and fired before you had the gig?
Yeah, sort of.
All right.
Sort of. It's complicated. It had to do with their management company. And,
okay.
It was complicated.
Yeah.
Not worth it yet.
That's a good example of a record that sounds really timeless, especially considering that it was 1980, whatever it was, 88, 89. And a lot of stuff sounds kind of shitty and dated from that era. Where was the bulk of that record done? And give me an idea of how long it took to make a record like that.
Wow. It probably took a while.
This is Steady On is the record.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't remember. It was cut at several different studios. We were really sort of it was a little bit guerrilla warfare to find places we could get in. Cause it wasn't as though we had the whole thing mapped out. We really block booked the place for 4 weeks and went in and did it. That kind of thing I would do later, but not for Steady On.
Okay.
Oh man, you know, it's complicated. Sean and I were a couple and we were breaking up. I mean, the whole thing was sort of fraught.
Okay.
Yeah. The whole thing was sort of fraught. Yeah. And, you know, we did a lot of it. At that point, there were these satellite rooms that the Hit Factory had. One was on 42nd Street. We did a bunch of it there. We did a bunch of the tracking there. We didn't do all the overdubs there. It took a while, you know, in those days, and even now, although we're not talking about working 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. I mean, I've never made records like that. Even with, let's say, Sarah, you know, it's just more relaxed. Plus, I'm busier. I tour with my wife. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
You know, back then, you know, because we're doing the writing too, you know, it's like there's a lot going on. It wasn't as though we had all the songs when we started. We probably had most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have to go away and like write the songs and kind of figure it out, and cast it, this, that, and the other thing. And what can I say about that record? I actually don't like the way it sounds, but I appreciate that. I think there's a certain freshness to it. Like there's a certain thing that it doesn't sound like everything else.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that's going to dovetail back to this thing we were talking about in the beginning where, I mean, look, man, you don't always get it, but that's part of my motivation and DNA too. It's like, I, you know, for better or worse, I try to put a little effort into not having these things I do sound like other things or particularly popular things or, you know, sometimes it's a little bit of an amorphous, complicated dance to sort of navigate your way through it to find something that feels fresh, and you don't always get it, but I think the motivation to try to do that is probably pretty healthy. It has been for me. I suspect it would be healthy for a lot of people, unless you're just really lockjawed into commercial music, which is a skill set too, which is like, mm-hmm. Man, I'm going to nail this formula for the eighth time, and
yeah.
You know, I'm going to, you know, my publisher's going to send me $20 million, and like I totally respect that. I didn't have that skill set, so why bother? So. I don't know, man. I just knew that I knew going in. I knew even in the demos that it was fresh, and that was a plus and a minus because it wasn't. I mean, she got a deal pretty quickly, but I'll tell you, my core group of friends, some of whom I've named, and many other friends I had who were doing sessions and trying to climb the ladder of the New York record making scene, none of them got it.
Really?
Yeah. And so that record, and that was a bit anxiety producing for me.
Do you mean while the record was being made, people were
like,
yeah,
or even when it was
done,
I played it for some people, my friends, and I could just see the blank thing because it didn't sound like anything, you know? And, you know, it was your first record, and you're like, oh, fuck.
What have I done?
Yeah, what have I done? That's it. Yeah. No, but then I discovered there's a kind of universe outside. You know, New York's a pretty powerful gravitational pull, or at least it was then, maybe not so much now. And, yeah, that there was a universe outside. God, all of these musicians in LA loved it. Musicians in Nashville loved it. And it was sort of like a door open for me. It was like, oh, well, this is kind of more of the world I'm going to navigate.
Yeah.
Even though I'm still here in New York City, probably the last guy standing, but there you go. Right.
And then as things went along with her, like the next record, Fat City, I don't know if if that was more complicated or
I didn't really have anything to do with that. I wrote two or three tunes with her. We needed a break from each other. So she went off. I think maybe I produced one track on it. I don't feel connected to that record at all. It's got nothing to do with it.
Okay. But then you did reconnect with her for other records.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we finally sort of reconnected for what I suspect is our best record. And the name of it is
Fusemore Paris.
Yeah.
And that was four or five years later, I guess, or something like that. Right?
Yeah, that was sort of like, in some ways it was a decade after we did Steady On.
Oh, it was that long? Okay.
Yeah, it was sort of, I think she did a couple of records in between. We really didn't talk for 5-6 years. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so how was the process like that for, because that's a really successful record too. Like,
yeah.
did you, and that probably had some of her biggest hits or did have her biggest hits, I'd imagine, Sunny Came Home and stuff. And actually, you mentioned that song too, but earlier where you recorded that song, and I'm not familiar with that studio or that guy, unfortunately. Can you tell me?
Hopefully some of your podcast listeners will know. Yeah, Sear Sound, it's still there.
Okay, so what's the deal with that place?
It's just great, man. It's it was a small room. God, it was a small room at the Hit Factory in the 70s. It's a very small 70s-ish studio. They have two rooms. They eventually built a second room, which I never liked the second room. Really small, kind of dead sounding, in a good way. Great Neve console. Walter had a sensational collection of microphones. The combination of Walter and Kevin Killen, I learned a lot about mics.
Walter was the engineer or the owner?
No, Walter owned the studio.
Okay.
He didn't engineer, he owned the studio. I'm sure there's a, I'll send you a link when we're done. He's very in New York. He's a very well-known character. Like I say, he's no longer with us. People are still making great, great records there. People love working at Sear. It's just a vibe. So I spent a lot of time there. I would say mid-90s to early 2000s. And that's where we did the Sunny Came Home record and probably did. That was also the first record. So ADATS had arrived. And that was the first, and that was also the first record I decided I wanted to try engineering.
Because
I would get sort of frustrated before that. And
frustrated with engineers, you mean?
Not personally, but just like I recognized that I needed to have an engineering skill set, basically.
Right.
Not frustrated individuals. No, so I've worked with a lot of great engineers. No.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I just kept hearing things in my head, and it's like I'm just wired. It's like this thing with instruments. Like I'm wired to want to learn and play a lot of instruments. I'm wired to want to engineer and mix. So to me, it's like, you know, what's the cliche? You know, it's another instrument. I mean, it's another skill. It's another way to make music and create music and craft feeling and texture and stuff that I like and that we all like. So it was the first record I started to engineer a lot, and I had ADATS, and so I would make these little sub mixes from the 24 track analog. This is pre-digital. That was an analog record. And I did all the crazy shit people did back then where I would, so we had all the basic tracks and all the drums and bass parts and 24 track analog. And then I would take these little sub mixes to my ADATS, and I had a little workspace in the East Village, and I would work, you know, I would sort of, you know, work on my overdubs, and we would do vocals there. And, I would, I remember adding, like, we cut Sunny Came Home, but it didn't have that mandolin intro. And when we cut it, I kept thinking like, man, this just needs a little something to start it. And I just picked up my mandolin and went ding, 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 ding. And I never in a million years thought this thing was going to be a hit. I thought, oh, well, this is kind of a groovy, little catchy little thing. But I never, it wasn't operating from a place of let's cut hits. Although I'm thrilled it was a hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, man. So that's how I did that record. And then, you know, we would sort of bounce back what I did.
Did you mix it too?
No, Bob Clear Mountain.
So you hadn't quite got to the mixing stage.
No. Okay. Well, no. I've been inspired and stolen from and been influenced by the best. You know, Bob Clear Mountain mixed a bunch of my records in the late '90s, early 2000s. Kevin Killen has mixed some of my records, and you know, I sort of paid attention. You know.
Yep.
And then eventually, I gave it a shot before computers. Even when it was still on my first record was on a what series, Neve. I can't remember. It's all going now. But and then once I went to computers, it's just, for me, it was just natural. Because when I'm producing, I'm basically mixing anyway. I mean, I'm mixing right. 80% of it. Then I just go that next level to really clean up. Mostly, you know, I don't do a lot, man. It's mostly reductive EQing and, you know, it's just shaping and clarifying. Yeah. And
the co-writing thing is really interesting to me. You seem to co-write basically with everybody on every project that you do. Is that like a requirement for you, or is it just like you don't feel like you can dig in a big enough way unless you've got some skin in the game as far as like the material goes? Or how does that work that you end up co-writing almost on every project?
Like you said.
Okay.
Oh man, I don't know. It's not a requirement. That just sounds horrible. I would never in a million years say to a prospective artist, look, it's a requirement. You have to write with me. No, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's the way, I mean, that's why I think I'm slightly weird in the record production thing. I kind of backed into it because I'm a player and a writer.
Yeah.
And the record production was the natural extension of being a player, slight multi-instrumentalist and a songwriter. Mm-hmm. With a kind of arranger sensibility. Well, that to me made it easy, not easy, but it seemed natural to want to make records. Do I like writing music with artists? Yeah, I love it. Do I like recording music I've written? Yeah, I love it. It's really fulfilling. It's really exciting. Do I have to just do that? Absolutely. Definitely not. I love arranging other people's and producing other people's stuff too. It's just a balance, just finding it. You know, I happen to be married to a great songwriter, so we do a lot of songwriting. But there are even times where she gets sick of my shit. You know, she wants to go off and write with other people. And it's like, yeah, you got to do it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, man, I think it's just part of my thing. You know, it's like, I like it. I mean, you know, it's pretty satisfying to write a good tune.
Has that process, say, with Sean Colvin, who it sounds like you've been writing with since the 80s, has that changed at all? Or do you guys just sit down and it's like 1985 all over again?
No. If it only was, yeah. No, Sean and I actually, we haven't made a record for a while now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
We're friends. Yeah, we're friends. And we're talking, and we've made some stabs at writing some stuff, and it's not coming as easy as it used to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think there's valid reasons why. One is part of it, once again, to fold it back to some of the first things we talked about, which is like, you know, my thing with her is like, well, why? I don't want to do anything that we've already made. It's like, at least I want to start from a place where I don't want to do what we've already done. Now, do I want to get like black and white and rigid about that? No, it sort of glides into something that feels that's familiar of something we've done, fine. But I felt like, I mean, all right, do you want to talk about this? I mean, this is the stuff I think about. So it's true. Like for me, what I would like to do with Sean, and she, we'll see if she can go there with us, is I think the one thing I haven't done is like, I want to make a record that really, really showcases what an incredible singer she is.
Hmm. Yeah.
And so for me, it sort of means writing a certain kind of tune that gives her the space to be as deeply evocative and open as a singer as possible. And not hem it in with a lot of pop music or folk or Americana conventions that which is, there's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. It's just, I want to start from a place like, man, I just want the first thing people to say when they hear it is like, Jesus, you sound great. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's complicated. It's a whole big aesthetic thing. It's just, yeah. this is the downside of having done it for a long time.
Yeah, right.
You start going over into different alleys and aesthetics, and like you start getting kind of existential about the whole thing. Like, but having said that, fingers crossed, we've written one thing that I love. Uh-huh. Anyway, a couple of things. She's written a couple of things on her own that are beautiful, and yeah, you know, so fingers crossed, we'll see.
A project like that sticks out to me too, that you did, was the William Bell one, which is super interesting. And again, like, you did a bunch of co-writing or writing for it. I'd imagine that was, like, I could be just guessing, or I'm definitely guessing here, but that process, was that a little tricky, like being able to, I guess, find a voice that worked for him, and also like just convincing him in the first place that he shouldn't do a bunch of like shitty R&B songs from some other era.
Yeah.
So just tell me a bit about that project, because that's a super cool record. But it's, I mean, I've talked to Joe Henry, I've done stuff with Joe Henry, and you know, he sort of has kind of a similar thing with the Solomon Burke record that he did. And I know that record was problematic for him, you know, artistically and just like from a producer's point of view. Was the William Bell thing tricky in some of those ways too?
Here's what I'll say. It was the most joyous record I've ever made.
Okay.
And I don't say this at all. I so value all the collaborators and records I've made, but in some ways, William's record is my favorite record I've ever made.
Interesting.
And now, why is it my favorite record? Because I feel in some ways it's the most me. So selfishly, it's my favorite record.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Well, before I started doing all this kind of pop Americana, you know, I mean, I started before people even called anything Americana. So, you know, I don't know what it is that I do, some sort of creative pop, folky, country, you know, I don't know, man, rootsy thing. I played in R&B bands in New York. If you didn't know how to play R&B, you didn't work.
Right.
So I have a deep, deep love for classic soul music and R&B. And I particularly have a deep love, you know, for Southern soul and R&B. And I mm-hmm. was fully, fully aware of who William was when the call came. And I was super excited. And it's also one of the rare times where I knew immediately what it was that I wanted to do.
Did they approach you about producing and writing, or was it more like he's got songs?
Yeah, I've been asked this question. This is so interesting. And I got to say this the right way. Yeah, I mean, they weren't against me writing, but they had been sort of fishing around for the right thing, the right producer. And, you know, I'm not an obvious choice here, by the way. And, you know, William had some tunes and he had been doing the co-writing thing. They'd been sending William around. And, you know, I hated all the tunes. Hate is maybe.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, it's not that I hated them. They were the thing that you described, which is when you make a soul record of like, of particularly a 60s artist, and there it's such a powerful language, and the language of any of these classic rootsy American things, or I mean, even the Beatles, it's like you start going down the road of the heavy gravitational pull, the magnet of the magnificence of when these things were original and vibrant and being created, and the cliches and the horn lines and the grooves and the little guitar double stop notes that we all love. I love, you love, everybody I know loves. It's, you have to have an internal navigator in which you don't default to regurgitating shit just because you love it or you know it works. To me, it makes for lifeless music. You're never going to do what they did 50 years ago. It's right. never going to be as compelling. It's never going to be as soulful. And it's, I don't like it when I hear it. I'm completely uninterested when I hear it. And I prayed that I wouldn't fall prey to it. So I act all cocky, like I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Well, I knew I didn't want, what I really did was I knew what I didn't want. I didn't want to do that. And then, okay, then what the fuck are you going to do? So, and I had some ideas. So a lot of guitar stuff I play when I'm just sitting by myself falls into a kind of soul guitar thing. So I had already song bits and ideas and little mm-hmm. sequences.
That you'd come up with him in mind, or that you just
yeah,
had
to with him and without him. Yeah, okay. Like I was ready for this record, man. Like I can't tell you.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, William's record was the most joyous record I've ever made. It was just like, I couldn't wait to work on it. So yeah, unlike who do you reference, Joe Henry? Like, no, I loved it. Also, William's a beautiful cat. So I'm sure I've heard stories about Solomon Burke. Doesn't sound like he was perhaps not as gracious a presence. William is just a beautiful cat. So part of it for me was also, and he's very reserved, and I knew I had to win him over. And I just said, well, look, man, just come up to New York for 2 days. We'll know in 48 hours whether there's anything to do. Man, we just hung out, talked. I already had a couple of ideas. I started playing guitar. I could tell he liked my guitar playing because I can kind of sit with an acoustic guitar and kind of create a soul feeling about stuff. And I don't want to say I seduced him, but I think we connected. And I actually love the man. I talked to him on a regular basis, and that was a big part of it. And I also talked to him a lot about his life, because I knew what I didn't want to do was, you know, oh, baby, let's get ready to party. You know, like I knew. No, it's like, well, Jesus, he was 76 at the time. And it's like, well, what are you going to sing about at 76? So that was, I've said this before in another interview. Yeah, I knew immediately the lyrics had to be, they couldn't be bullshit. Like the lyrics had to have some, like a great country song has to have a great lyric. And so, you know, I just spent some time with the lyric. I have a longstanding songwriting partnership with my friend Mark Cohn, who happens to be a lyricist. And the only part that was challenging, and I say this with all respect, is that William thinks of himself as a writer, and he's written four songs that are just extraordinary. One of the best blues songs of all time, Born Under a Bad Sign, one of the greatest soul ballads of all time, Everybody Loves a Winner. Mm-hmm. When you lose alone. You Don't Miss Your Water Till Your Well Run Dries. William's written some great
heavy
fucking songs. Yeah. Like, it had been a while since he'd been challenged lyrically. Okay. In fact, he probably hadn't been challenged in decades.
Yeah.
And so the challenge was how to challenge William and be graceful and involve him in the journey of where I knew it had to go. Cause he wasn't sure.
Okay. Were you leaning on him to write most of the lyrics?
Well, no, but he needs to feel involved.
Yeah.
It'd be easy for me to go off and write the songs myself or write the songs with my buddy Mark Cohn, or I wrote a song with Roseanne. You know, she wrote a great lyric. I tried to write a Gamble and Huff tune about it. And I wanted William to be involved. It's William Bell. It's William freaking Bell. Yeah. It's like, no, I needed William to be involved. And sometimes that was tricky because a lot of time had passed since he'd been gone. He had not gone to the level that I was trying to go, right? I was going through, I mean, humbly. I say this humbly. I was really trying to go for the real thing, man. I was just trying to go for it. So, boom, there you go. Great. So, au contraire, I love that record. My favorite.
Did he bring stuff to you that you had to be like, this isn't going to cut it?
I didn't bother with any of the tunes that they sent. He was involved with some of that stuff. I took a title he had and I rewrote it.
Okay.
And then he had, I mean, it wasn't just all me and Mark. Like, I'm not stupid. No, William and I wrote two, if not three songs just together, like on the floor.
Yeah.
And one of them, he had the initial lyric idea. And you know, we wrote like three or four songs together like that. You know, and the rest I probably wrote with Mark or wrote on my own or wrote one with Rose. We wrote together too. Yeah. Okay. I just knew I had to pull it to something other than pure soul music cliches, if that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. Right. I totally get it. Right. So with Roseanne, you've obviously been co-writing with her a long time and making records with her for probably 20 years now, I think, right? Rules of Travel is probably the first one. Is that
30?
30 years?
Yeah, 30 years.
What's the first record you worked with her on?
It's called The Wheel.
Oh, okay. So
pretty good record.
What's the history there? Were you guys married at that time when you started working together?
No.
Okay. The relationship evolved as the music evolved as well.
Yeah. We fell in love, you know. I really married quite an exceptional human being, so.
Yeah.
Took me. I was pretty thick, so it took me a little while to realize it because I'm basically a lunkhead. But yeah, she's I married an extraordinary human being. Yeah.
How long have you guys been married for?
We've been married, this will be 28 years this year, but we've been together for 30, this year will be 31 we've been together.
So. Wow. Okay. So substantial period of time of your life.
Yeah.
And has the process changed for you guys as far as making records goes?
Yeah, I can't listen to any of the early records I made with Roseanne. I feel like I did a terrible job. I don't think I
really?
Was. Yeah. Yeah, this is complicated. I can't believe I'm talking about all this stuff. You're like Barbara Walters. You're getting all this shit out of me, man.
Yeah, man. Where does that change for you? Like, is there a line in the sand where it's like, oh, suddenly these records, I can listen to them? Where is that?
Yeah. Something shifted in my production or my record making around 2010-ish. Okay. And it started with, or maybe slightly before. I can't. I'm bad with dates. I made a record with Roseanne of cover tunes called The List.
The List.
And
which is a crazy project. Like, so that was a List.
Crazy project. It was a lot of fun. Actually, it was a lot of fun to do.
And, am I right in understanding that that was a list that her dad gave her of like the great songs of all time? Oh my God.
Yeah, I did. And it was sort of the same thing with Williams record, which is like, well, how are we going to F them up so that they feel soulful? They're not just cliches of the versions that everybody else has done. La-di-da. But there was just something shifted. I think part of it was, I don't know. I mean, it's not black and white. And I don't know how interesting this is to anybody, but
it's really interesting.
Is it?
I don't know.
Something has shifted in me where I just made a move towards simplicity. And it was a good move for me. It was the right move for me to do it at the time. And it was, what's the least amount I can do to convey the most? And it was just a slightly different way. I was tired of what I was doing, and I wasn't particularly liking the results. Like, I didn't really care for that record, Rules of Child. I just feel like, what the fuck? You're doing all this stuff thinking you're trying to be hip or these weird sounds. And I just got, and sort of also broke with any interest in weird sounds or lo-fi or hi-fi or trying to be hip or trying to pay attention to anything other than what was in my heart and my head. And it was all involved in just, let's just move toward being simpler. And I think for me, anyway, my records since then, for me, they've gotten better. I think they're better. I don't know, you know, except everybody else, you know, and they've done better. Unfortunately, it's all coincided with, you know, with the de-evolution of the music business. So, but they've all won Grammy, you know, I've won a lot more Grammys in the last 10 or so years than I did before. And, you know, they've, I just think I just found a better way to do it. And part of it is that I started playing more, as engineering more, as mixing them. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to be more concise and just, you know, find the right bits that really worked. And
that simplicity that you talk about, was that partly coming out because you're like approaching all these classic country songs that were sort of, a lot of them were super iconic as they were. And I understand how hard that is to approach some of those songs without feeling like, oh my God, what are we, like, why are we doing this?
Well, certainly that's a valid question. Why are we doing this? So I look at it, how do I look at it? Well, it's what I said. There's never any point in redoing something someone's already done really well, right? So there's never any point in that. Like, why would you do that? It's just doomed to failure. It's zero sum way of approaching making a record. And then you're left with, well, what can you do that's interesting and compelling and that could retain people's interest in it and surprise them and maybe infuse it with a little life, but at the same time, try to sound, dare I say, timeless, where it doesn't feel pegged to the moment or pegged to the technology or pegged to how much compression or reverb or delay people are using in this particular time or this drum sound. You know, it's like, that's the thing that changed for me, is like, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, where it's like, I just tried to go back to drum sounding like drums, you know, I lost interest in anything other than, can you arrange this in a way that's still really cool and exciting and interesting to hear and takes you on a journey, but is trying to stay simple and musical. So for me, it's like, it's arranging. And for me, that kind of arranging is like songwriting. It's just pulling on your songwriting tunes, which is, well, how can you take a song everybody's heard a million times and twist it in a way where it sounds new, but you retain the song? And so there's a great, I've mentioned this in interviews. If you ever have the time and can find it, you know, I like Nelson Riddle quite a bit. So sure. I also have incredibly eclectic taste. you know, like there's just tons of orchestral composers I really love. Copland, Ives, Samuel Barber, Stravinsky. I mean, it's just endless. Ravel, you know, and there's film composers I love. Bernard Herrmann, mm-hmm. one who I really love. And, you know, I love Nelson. There's one particular Frank Sinatra record. I think it's Only the Lonely or Only for the Lonely. It's just, to me, it's like operatic. It's amazing. The arrangements are off the charts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he wrote this book on arranging. So I bought it. So I go, oh, let's check it out. You know, and basically the bottom line is for stuff like that for me is like the chords, the groove are up for grabs and the melody's not and the lyric isn't. You got to honor the melody and you got to honor the lyric. And then at the end of the day, you're trying to look for a real feeling behind it. So how can you mess with the harmony or the rhythm and find a way, the arrangement or find a way to do it or get rid of the chords? Or there's I have a million strategies. Oh, there's five chords here. We're just going to use one chord. Or, you know, it's like there's a million ways to think about it. And, you know, and if you love music as much as I do, I suspect as much as you do, and you pay attention, it just, as I've said in the past, it just sort of becomes part of your toolbox of, oh, God, I remember that cadence from that arrangement of Will It Weep For Me by Frank Sinatra and Nelson Riddle. Man, can I use that little cadence right here? Well, I did. On Roseanne record, you know, like that's how it works for me. You know, steel subtly, gracefully, but steel, right? Yeah. And so
are you and Roseanne making another record right now, or going to be?
Well,
or?
We're not. We should. We just started to talk about. It. Of course, I haven't produced anything for a couple of years, and now it feels like I'm overwhelmed a little bit with possibilities. But no, what Roseanne and I have been doing for the last year, really, honestly, for the last 5 years, on and off, is that we've written the score to a musical that we hope.
What's that called?
It's called, okay, here we go. I guess we'll talk about, we talked about my solo record. I guess it's time to talk about this. Although I hope it doesn't jinx. I haven't really talked about this because I don't know if you've ever been involved in musical theater. It's really freaking complicated.
I have not.
Lots of egos, lots of stuff.
Really? Okay.
Oh man, it's crazy. And music is quite often the lowest rung of the ladder.
I know that from working in film stuff and TV stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's very
frequently an afterthought.
Film. Yeah, yeah. It's very, very similar. Sometimes it feels like I'm just working on a jingle. Yeah, that's true. We were approached by a producer and a book writer like 5 or 6 years ago to write the score for a musical version of a film from the 70s called Norma Rae. And it's about unionization of a textile mill in North Carolina in the mid-70s. Not your usual fodder for musical theater. So it's been a long journey. I won't bore you with all the details, although literally I could write a book about it. It's been that interesting and that wild with triumphs and tragedy. But the bottom line is we did our first full cast, choreography, full band. I did the arrangements. We did like six performances in a small space for basically theater world and backers and stuff. And it went pretty well. And we've got some good offers. I probably shouldn't say them. I don't know how that works, but we've got as far as trying to get a trajectory toward Broadway, which is commercial theater.
Yeah.
We're on the right path. So we're like one step removed. So it could still all fall apart, man, because it's pretty crazy. But theoretically, a year from now, we'll have an 8-week like production in the biggest sort of non-commercial theater in New York. And then if that goes well,
that's exciting. You know,
well, yeah, I try not to get too excited. Like I say, dude, it's when I say complicated.
So you guys wrote the music and you arranged it. Are you performing it as well? Or do you just sit back and watch it all go down?
No. It's been an interesting experience to find musicians and stuff to not know. In fact, I don't want to have anything to do with performing it. No, I wrote the music. Roseanne wrote the lyrics. And we have like an 8-person band. I have a wonderful musical director. And it took a while to find the language I was looking for, which is this kind of haunted Appalachia thing with an overlay of church, black and white church, actually. And but I found a great crew of your professional local 802 musicians here in New York.
Yeah, I bet.
And these guys are great. None of them, except for the bass player, I hadn't worked with any of them before, and they're all wonderful. Very lucky to have them. Yeah, it's a totally different experience to just sit there and listen to what you've written be played. So,
wow, that's quite something. Huge project, though.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you going to tour solo for your record or anything, or is that really in the cards?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I was asked about a couple of things. I don't know, man.
Maybe Roseanne Cash needs an opening act.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get a lot of space to play when we do a duo. Like, it's pretty fluid. So it's like, I get to play a lot. I don't know, Steve. It's like, I'm not, you know.
You should. It'd be cool, man.
I don't know if I'm an artist, capital A. You know what I mean? Like, this was just music that was in me. I wanted to get out. We'll see. Maybe that'll be the next challenge. Can I go do a gig? Oh, my God. It would be really painful to do a gig by myself. If I could have at least one or two friends with me to back me, that might be cool.
Yeah. Right on. Well, thank you, John, for taking all this time with me.
Well, man, yeah, we went longer and deeper than I thought we would.
We didn't ask
about gear, and I'm sort of really impressed.
I love gear. I just don't really want to talk about it.
I like it.
All right. Well, I hope to see you again. The last time I saw you was here. You were doing that Johnny Cash show with Rye and Joaquin and Roseanne. That was awesome. I loved that.
Yeah, I love Rye. He's a massive influence on me. So. Was really quite an experience to get to play the music with him.
All right. Well, thanks so much, John.
All right. Down the road. I'll talk.
All right. See ya.
There.
All right, folks. That was my conversation with John Leventhal. I sure enjoyed speaking with him and finding out the scoop on all things to do with his latest shenanigans and all of his past recording experiences as well. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We shall see you then. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Henhouse Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.